Isaiah highlights chapters 1 through 55, the 35th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on March 29, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 5, Isaiah Highlights, chapters 1 through 55, accompanies this talk.
I decided to take this time to review the chapters that we have gone through in Isaiah up to now. We've done 55 chapters now, and that is a lot for my little brain. Hard for me to keep that all in my head at the same time and to remember what has been covered and how it's been talked about and assimilate all of that stuff. And it's been a long time, too. I've been working on this for several years now. So I decided to go back over it and for myself and then present a summary of what has been covered. First of all, just background into which this is being written. Jack was talking about these being troubled times. The times in which Isaiah was writing were also troubled times. There was trouble in the Middle East. What was happening is there were three countries in which, just within a three-year span of time, three kings had died and been replaced by a new king. And in the ancient world, whenever a king died and was replaced, that was always a time of trouble. It was always a time of potential trouble. Because with that change of leadership, there was always the possibility that someone would rise up and take advantage of a new king solidifying his power base and cause trouble. Either a coup or who knows, there were lots of options. As a result, this was one of those times when there was a lot of unrest because there was this concern in three different countries at the same time that there might be unrest. In addition to that, the kingdom of Assyria, which had previously been a world power and had been a formidable world power, a merciless military-based society, but they had fallen into decline for a number of years, but now they're starting to get things back together, and it looks ominous. And everyone knows if Assyria gets its act together, that it's going to come west, and it's going to be trouble for all of the countries in the Levant, on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. So that's what's in view. And so the countries on the Levant, they're trying to figure out how they'll deal with this threat of the Assyrians coming. And what is happening is there are alliances being formed, and they're trying to get more and more countries into their alliances, make those alliances as big as possible so that they can hold off the threat of the Assyrians. And in particular, it is Aram and the northern kingdom of Israel that have joined together, and they want the southern kingdom, Judah, to join in with them. And if Judah will not join in with them willingly, they will force Judah to join in with them. Aram and Israel are both bigger, wealthier countries than is Judah at this particular time. But it is to Judah that Isaiah is speaking. And he's going to say, don't join that alliance. So we'll get to that in just a minute. But Isaiah was commissioned to be a prophet to Judah at this particular point in time. And what he is tasked with is helping the people of Judah to get perspective on what's going on. And as best I understand it, what God knows is coming, and what he wants to prepare Judah for, is going to be a lot of suffering in Judah. They are going to go through one hard thing after the next. They have been through some hard things, but it's going to ramp up. And Isaiah is coming to Judah to warn them that it is going to ramp up, but I want you to understand what is happening. And there's the possibility when things get tougher that people are going to think, God, our God is weak, so we need to worship other gods, or our God is ignoring us, or our God has abandoned us. So Isaiah is coming to inform them what is happening. God is not weak. He isn't ignoring them. He hasn't forgotten them. But they are coming under a greater and greater discipline over a period of time. And so that's what is actually happening. So Isaiah comes to warn them that this discipline is coming and to predict some of that in advance, explain it to them in advance so that they know how to face into it, how to deal with it. Okay, now the organization of the book of Isaiah has all the way through, that has been a struggle for me, trying to figure out how the thought is progressing through the book. And there are blocks. There's a block of thought, and then another block of thought, and then another block of thought. It's just a lot of blocks of thought. But there are very few transitions between the blocks. So it's hard to know how it's progressing, what kind of argument is being built. In going back through it, I realized something that I have found to be very helpful. And that is, Isaiah feels obligated to throw in corrective statements. So, if he is talking about all of the discipline that is coming and the difficult times that are ahead for Judah, he will almost always break into that someplace and talk about Judah's great future that's out there. So he's breaking up the hard times with what they have to look forward to in the future. And he does that quite consistently through the book. And in fact, in the early chapters, he focuses on the hard things that are coming with just a few blocks to break that up. But as you progress through the book, it shifts towards the end. The focus is on Judah's great future and just a few blocks to remind them the hard times are coming. He will do the same thing with the punishment that's in store for the wicked. And he will throw in a corrective to that, but the just will find peace. There are a couple of other themes that he does that with as well. So he tends to want to put in a corrective to dilute this, whatever his emphasis is at a particular point in time. When I recognize that, the progression through the book is a lot less jerky. It makes a lot more sense. And I found that to be very helpful. I have divided the book up into, let's see, 9 sections. And generally speaking, commentaries all break it up at these same points. So these breaking points, I think, are probably pretty clear. The divisions are then the first 5 chapters are an introduction. Chapters 6 through 12 are prophetic warnings against aligning with Israel and Iran. The third section is talking about the destruction that's going to come upon the foes of Israel in chapters 13 through 23. That's followed by just a short section on the destruction of the world, chapters 24 through 27. Then there's another section of prophetic warnings against allying themselves, Judah allying themselves, but this time it's with Egypt. That's chapters 28 through 35. Then there's a short section where it is historical narrative that he breaks in with. And that seems to be emphasizing the historical realization of some of the short-term prophecies that have been given. The 7th section is that only Yahweh is in control of history, chapters 40 through 48. The 8th section talks about the servant being God's agent to bring salvation to the world, chapters 49 to 55. And then the last section is the worldwide reign of righteousness, chapters 56 through 66. Now, I debated at great length as to how to proceed through this, and finally decided that what I'm going to do is go through each of those sections. I'm going to talk about some key verses in each section as kind of an outline of that section. So I'm going to be reading in out of the Bible quite a bit. Hopefully you got a handout, and if you wanted to print it out, then you printed it out. You might be able to get it on your smartphone if you didn't print it out. You can follow along, you can just listen to me read, or you can follow along in the Bible, whichever works best for you. But I want to go through this, read a number of passages, and make some commentary on how they all fit together. And then at the end, I'm going to summarize what I think is the message of the book as a whole. So in the introductory section, chapters 1 through 5, it begins talking about the people of Israel. I'll use the term Israel. He's primarily speaking to the kingdom of Judah, but as we get further in the book, it becomes clear that it's what he's saying is applicable both to Judah and to Israel. So I may interchange them. But he's talking about, he's listing his grievances with respect to the people of Judah, why it is that he has anything against them. He starts out with a couple of analogies in verses 2 and 3. He says, "Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand." So God has, for years, has been dealing with the people of Israel, making them into a people, taking care of them, and developing them into an independent country. And in spite of that track record that he has established with them, they are like sons who have revolted against their father. They are like animals that don't know who feeds them. They're like domesticated animals that don't know who feeds them. So they're taking God for granted. Starting with verse 5, and he talks about the situation as it stands now. "Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? The whole head is sick, the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is nothing sound in it, only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil." In other words, Judah is like this body that has been whipped, has been hit with a rod to discipline it to such an extent that there is no place untouched by the rod, and the wounds are unattended to. That is the nature of Judah as it is at this point in time. And what Isaiah is going to make abundantly clear is, unfortunately, there will have to be more discipline coming. What is it that God asks of them? Verses 16 and 17, he says, "Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your deeds from my sight. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Reprove the ruthless. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow." It's what he's asking is relatively simple. That is, do what is right. And in particular, an emphasis on the need to look out for those who are powerless. So, a day of reckoning is coming. Chapter 2, verse 12. "For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, and against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. And it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up, against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains, against all the hills that are lifted up, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft. And the pride of man will be humbled, and the loftiness of men will be abased, and the Lord alone will be exalted at that day. But the idols will completely vanish, and men will go into caves of the rocks and into holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and before the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day men will cast away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs. Before the terror of the Lord, the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. Stop regarding man, whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? So everything that is to be strong is all going to be humbled before God. God is going to make everything pale by comparison with his strength and might. And it's going to be traumatic. People are going to be scrambling for places to hide, places to go for refuge, and their idols, whatever their idols are, their idols will be of no value. They'll discover that those idols are just a burden and cast them to the side. And the last verse is a significant one. Stop regarding man whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? One of the problems that you see running through Isaiah is that the people of Judah worry too much about human beings, human institutions, what other countries are going to do, that they cannot stand before God, and yet Judah is fearful before them. Now, he throws in, however, that a remnant will survive and thrive. And I'm going to read a little bit more than I have written down here. I'll start with 4, verse 2. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. Then the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. Then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy, and there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. So in the end, a remnant will survive, and that remnant will be cared for abundantly by God and will be purified. In chapter 5, then, he gives this analogy of what his relationship to Judah is like. And he likens it to a vineyard. This analogy is going to show up elsewhere in Isaiah, so I will read the whole thing, verses 1 through 6. Let me sing now for my well-beloved, a song for my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. And I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. So he's likening Judah to a vineyard that the farmer has planted. He's put a hedge around it. He's put a wall around it to protect it. He's taken very good care of it, and it produced bad grapes. So what is the vineyard owner going to do? He's going to tear down the hedges and walls that have protected it for so long, and the animals are going to come in and trample it, and he's not going to take care of it the way that he has. It won't be hoed, it won't be pruned, and briars and thorns are going to come up in it. So that's Isaiah's warning. That's what's coming. That's what God is going to do. Okay, so that's the introductory section. that kind of lays out the situation and the themes that the rest of the book will develop. In the second section, he is focusing more specifically on the issue at hand, and that is, what should Judah do with respect to this problem that it faces? The problem being that in all likelihood an Assyrian invasion will come, and how is Judah going to protect itself against that? And its neighbors are insisting that it join the alliance, and Isaiah is going to say, don't do it. First of all, we have an account of Isaiah being commissioned as a prophet in chapter 6, verse 8. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then I said, here am I, send me. And he said, go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. It is becoming abundantly clear to me, I'm working through Jeremiah right now, being a prophet is not a fun job. They ran into all kinds of problems, and in this case, Isaiah is going to run into frustration that he is being sent to them with a message, but they are not going to listen to the message. But that's what he has been commissioned to do. Chapter 7, I'll go to verse 3. Here we have what Isaiah is supposed to say to the king of Judah, Ahaz. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool, on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, take care and be calm, have no fear, and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Don't fear. Earlier he said, don't fear man. And here is, again, stressing, don't fear. Don't be afraid of them, and don't, therefore, be forced to join their alliance. So I'm going to skip now to chapter 9, and I will read the first part of that chapter, because in here it's introducing this glorious future that awaits Israel. But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, she treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea, on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Thou shalt multiply the nation. Thou shalt increase their gladness. They will be glad in thy presence with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou shalt break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and the cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. This theme is introduced, but he doesn't really explain things very well. But this theme will keep coming back in various forms, but it's filling out the picture of this glorious future that awaits Judah and Israel, and that there will be a king of the line of David who will be the ruler, the righteous ruler, in this era of a glorious kingdom of Israel. So we're just teased with this, and it'll keep coming back, and they'll fill it out a little bit more. So to prepare Israel for this destiny, God is going to continue the discipline. And there will be foe after foe that comes to Judah and implements that discipline. In verse 12 of chapter 9, it's going to go through the rest of chapter 9. It goes through talking about some of what's coming. And there are several times in verse 12, in verse 17, in verse 21, in verse 4 of chapter 10, it repeats this refrain. This refrain is, in spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretching out. In other words, there's more coming. It describes some of the suffering that's going to come, but then this refrain comes back, but there's more after that, and there's more after that, and there's more after that. Okay, and then it spells out more of the reason why this is all coming. In chapter 10, verse 1, woe to those who enact evil statutes and to those who constantly record unjust decisions so as to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people of their rights in order that widows may be their spoil and that they may plunder the orphans. So again, it's injustice. More often than not, Isaiah seems to level his accusations to the leadership of Israel. There's a lot about the injustices that are being carried out by those who are in positions of power, which is interesting because it's a sharp contrast with this picture of the king from the line of David that's going to rule during the righteous era. That has to sound like a wonderful potential. Now, he talks about, and this is another one of those counteracting things, that Judah is going to be disciplined. Judah is going to suffer. But those who administer the suffering to Israel, they are going to suffer as well. He talks about Assyria in verse 5. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I will send it against a godless nation and commission it against the people of my fury, to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the streets. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. Assyria is coming as an agent of God's discipline, but Assyria isn't going to be thinking, oh, we're carrying out Yahweh's discipline. They're coming to expand their power and their rule and their wealth, not to do God's bidding. But in fact, they will be doing God's bidding. And in verse 12 it says, so it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this. For I have understanding, and I removed the boundaries of the peoples and plundered their treasures, and like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants, etc. I won't read on. But Assyria is going to be punished for that which it does, even though there is a sense in which it is a tool in God's hands. He returns then in chapter 11 to that glorious future, starting with verse 1. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. And he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the lion will lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox, and the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the earth. Then it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. That has to be an extremely attractive picture, this time of unrest, this time of danger, trouble on the horizon, and in a time when the people, the leaders of Judah, have abused their power and taken advantage of those who are powerless. A just ruler, a ruler who will judge in fairness and justice. Another theme that is introduced here, and it's interesting that it's introduced here at a time that apparently is before anyone from either Judah or Israel has been taken into exile into other parts of the Near East. He talks about them being gathered, verse 12, and he will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. That's a theme that we'll see developed more as we go on, this idea of the people of Israel being collected from all over the earth back home. Then he ends this section with a chapter in which he praises God for all of this. Verse 1 of chapter 12. Then you will say on that day, I will give thanks to thee, O Lord, for although thou wast angry with me, thine anger is turned away, and thou dost comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for the Lord God is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. So God's wrath will have an end to it. When it has accomplished its purposes, that wrath will end, and God is the salvation of Israel and will be their Savior. Okay, so that's the second section of Isaiah. This third one is the one that I still have the most difficult time understanding. It is a section in which he goes through and talks about the various foes of Israel. And he talks about the judgment that is coming on them. I'm not going to go through this in detail. It does seem to be a part of the genre of prophetic literature. Jeremiah has a section in which he does the same thing. Ezekiel has a section where he does the same thing. And I was looking through. Amos has a section where he does this. Joel has a section. Obadiah, Zephaniah, Zechariah. All of those prophets have a section within their book where they proclaim these destruction, this condemnation of the surrounding foes of Israel. In Isaiah, the neighbors that are picked out are Babylon, Assyria, Philistia, Moab, Damascus, Ethiopia, Egypt, Edom, Arabia. And then it has this oracle proclaimed against the wilderness of the sea, which appears to be the border of the Persian Gulf, along the Persian Gulf. And then there's a section, an oracle proclaimed with respect to the Valley of Vision, which appears to be Jerusalem. So here, this is breaking the mold. It's not a foe of Israel from the outside, but it's Jerusalem itself, and it's talking about some of what's coming to Jerusalem. And then the last one is Tyre. As going through those proclamations, those oracles proclaimed to the foes of Israel, most of them describe some kind of destruction that's going to come to those nations. But it's hard to tell whether that's some kind of destruction that's coming in the short term or whether that's coming in the long term. I have a book at home that goes through and argues that all of those things that are predicted, all of those prophecies with respect to these countries surrounding Israel, are for the short term, that they are all fulfilled within the next 70 to 100 years. As I read through it, I have trouble seeing it as all of them being short-term. Some of them have to be short-term. In two occasions, it tells when it's going to come to pass. And in one, it says within a year. There's another one where it says within 3 years, as a hired man counts his days or whatever, something along those lines. So those have to be on the short term, but others seem to be too grand a prediction to have come to pass in the short term. I'm just going to give one example, which I think is a fascinating one. I don't know what it means. It's just in chapter 19, verses 16 to 25. This is with respect to Egypt. The first part of chapter 19, it talks about the catastrophe that's coming, the streams of the Nile drying up, and other things. But when we get to 16, and interestingly, it says, in that day, at the beginning of every paragraph here. And I think that is indicating that we're talking about something in the more distant future. But let me do this and you'll see what I'm puzzling over. In that day, the Egyptians will become like women, and they will tremble and be in dread because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he is going to wave over them. And the land of Judah will become a terror to Egypt. Everyone to whom it is mentioned will be in dread of it, because of this of the Lord of hosts, which he is purposing against them. Now, in the short term, I don't know of a time that fits that description, when Egypt was in dread of Judah. Next paragraph. In that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will be speaking the language of Canaan and swearing allegiance to the Lord of hosts. One will be called the city of destruction. In that day, there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord near its border. And it will become a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they will cry to the Lord because of oppressors, and he will send them a savior and a champion, and he will deliver them. Thus the Lord will make himself known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. And they will even worship with sacrifice and offering, and will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. And the Lord will strike Egypt, striking but healing. So they will return to the Lord, and he will respond to them, and he will heal them. Now, we know historically that there were a few cities in Egypt to which a large number of Jews from Judah and also from Israel went and settled in order to get away from the troubled times in Palestine. So 5 days in the land of Egypt will be speaking the language of Canaan. Maybe. I mean, you were talking about Jews going there and having an influence on the people there. We also know that there was a high priest who fled Jerusalem and went to Egypt and built a replica of the temple in Jerusalem. He built a replica in Egypt, and there was a large number of Jews that went down and settled there. And maybe that's what it's talking about in that next section. Maybe. Let's look at the last two sections. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrians will come to Egypt, and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel will be the third party with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. It seems to me that the language there is of such a nature that we can't point to a time in history when that has been fulfilled up to this day. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, that this section is sprinkled with things like that that appear to be talking about a more distant future, something yet to come to pass. Okay, another thing that is interesting in this third section is that there is sometimes an upside for these nations that have catastrophe and judgment coming to them, that there will be a remnant that will be saved, as we just saw here. Okay, so the picture that emerges from this section, let me just give you the highlights rather than reading through verses in here. But these are the highlights that come out of this and the kind of impressionistic picture that emerges. First is that there is a great judgment that is coming. It will be punishment for evil. It will be directed towards Israel and the rest of the world. The agent of this judgment will be manifold. It will be so horrible that people will be struck numb. There will be great destruction and loss of life, and it will sneak up on people. The second thing, nothing will provide security from this judgment and God's wrath. No fortress or military will be saved. No amount of money will save people. No country will be spared. The proud will be brought low. No God or religion will provide protection. And God alone is willing and able to save. Third, there will be a restoration of Israel. Israel will be freed from its oppression at the hands of the enemies. The authority of the world rulers will be broken. Israel will be the center of the world. Israel will be at peace with God. And God's disciplining of Israel will finally turn the hearts of a remnant. Fourth, there is hope for other peoples. A striking but a healing is the phrase that we just saw. A remnant will be given mercy. They will worship in Jerusalem. They will be God's people also, and there will be world peace. The fourth thing that emerges is God planned it all. He planned it from the very beginning. God has orchestrated everything that has come to pass, and he is accomplishing all of his purposes. Nothing is out of his control. Okay, so that's the third section. The fourth section is a short one in which he talks about the destruction of the world, and I think this one is, because of the language that is used, has to apply to something that is yet to be. Verses 1 through 6 of chapter 24. Behold, the Lord lays the earth waste, devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, the maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. The earth will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth mourns and withers. The word fades. The world fades and withers. The exalted of the people of the earth fade away. The earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. Then he proclaims glory to God for this happening. Chapter 25, verse 1. O Lord, thou art my God. I will exalt thee. I will give thanks to thy name. For thou hast worked wonders, plans formed long ago with perfect faithfulness. Verse 9 of that same chapter. And it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God for whom we have waited, that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in salvation. So there's going to be this remnant that waits for God, that stays faithful and endures throughout the difficult times that they face. So he encourages us to endure it. Chapter 26, verse 20 and 21. Come, my people, enter into your rooms and close your doors behind you. Hide for a little while until indignation runs its course. For behold, the Lord is about to come out from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. And the earth will reveal her bloodshed and will no longer cover her slain. In chapter 27, verses 2 through 6, in that day, this is relating back to the analogy of the vineyard that he used earlier. In that day, a vineyard of wine, sing of it. I, the Lord, am its keeper. I water it every moment, lest anyone damage it. I guard it night and day. I have no wrath. Should someone give me briars and thorns in battle, then I would step on them. I would burn them completely, or let them rely on my protection. Let him make peace with me. Let him make peace with me. In the days to come, Jacob will take root, Israel will blossom and sprout, and they will fill the whole world with fruit. So here we have an Israel that is acting the way that the vineyard was supposed to act from the very beginning. And it will be producing good fruit, and it will fill the whole world. And God will protect it. Okay, the next section then is a section which apparently this is a section that comes later in time, where now the threat the interest in Judah is not so much in an alliance with Israel and Aram, because at this point in time, they are probably already conquered by Assyria. Now the interest is in making an alliance with Egypt to protect them. He starts out with a charge against Ephraim and then his charge against Judah. So against God's charge against the northern kingdom and against Judah. And I'll just read a little bit at the beginning of chapter 28 with respect to Ephraim. Woe to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim and to the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley of those who are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord has a strong and mighty agent, a storm of hail, a tempest of destruction, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters. He has cast it down to the earth with his hand. Talking there about the coming of Assyria. Verse 14:15, then he shifts his attention to Judah. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, O scoffers who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by, for we have made falsehood our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. In other words, they are going behind God's back to make an agreement with Egypt to protect them against Assyria. But Israel predicts that Jerusalem is going to be besieged. In chapter 29, verse 3, I'll read 1 through 3, it says, O Ariel, Ariel seems to be a reference to Jerusalem. So verse 1, Woe, O Ariel, Ariel, the city where David once camped, and add year to year, observe your feasts on schedule, and it will bring distress to Ariel. And she shall be a city of lamenting and mourning, and she shall be like an Ariel to me. And I will camp against you, encircling you, and I will set siege works against you, and I will raise up battle towers against you. So they're doing the religious ritual, but it is empty ritual. That's a theme that he hits a number of times in this book. So he's saying, go ahead, keep doing your ritual, but trouble is coming. And in particular, Jerusalem will be encircled with siege works. But, and again, this is this corrective that he has to throw in chapter 29, verse 8, he says, And it will be as when a hungry man dreams, and behold, he is eating. But when he awakens, his hunger is not satisfied. Or as when a thirsty man dreams, and behold, he is drinking. But when he awakens, behold, he is faint, and his thirst is not quenched. Thus the multitude of all the nations shall be who wage war against Mount Zion. So those nations who come against Zion, even though they're coming, carrying out God's judgment, they come, they will be dissatisfied, they will not be satisfied as they try to conquer Israel, conquer Judah. It's going to be like someone, a hungry man dreaming. He's not going to get satisfaction, fulfillment. Chapter 30, verses 1 through 3, he warns them against an alliance with Egypt. He says, Woe to the rebellious children, declares the Lord, who execute a plan, but not mine, and make an alliance, but not of my spirit, in order to add sin to sin, who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me, to take refuge in the safety of Pharaoh, and to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore, the safety of Pharaoh will be your shame, and the shelter in the shadow of Egypt your humiliation. But Judah will not listen to God. We see that in verse 9 of that same chapter. He says, For this is a rebellious people, false sons, sons who refuse to listen to the instruction of the Lord, who say to the seers, You must not see visions, and to the prophets, You must not prophesy to us what is right. Speak to us pleasant words. Prophesy illusions. I love that. Prophesy illusions. That they want to dictate that the prophets give them warm, fuzzy feelings, pleasant news. That's a theme that comes up in Jeremiah. Interesting. But despite their rebelliousness. God is eager to be gracious to them. We see that in verse 18 of this same chapter. Therefore, the Lord longs to be gracious to you, and therefore he waits on high to have compassion on you. For the Lord is a God of justice. How blessed are all those who long for him. Well, I'll read a little further. O people in Zion, inhabitant in Jerusalem, you will weep no longer. He will surely be gracious to you at the sound of your cry when he hears it. He will answer you. Although the Lord has given you bread of privation and water of oppression, he, your teacher, will no longer hide himself, but your eyes will behold your teacher, and your ears will hear a word behind you. This is the way, walk in it, whenever you turn to the right or to the left. And you will defile your graven images overlaid with silver and your molten images plated with gold. You will scatter them as an impure thing and say to them, be gone. That eventually God's activity in the life of Judah will have its effect, and he will have compassion on them, and he will be very generous towards them. And he says in chapter 23, Egypt can't really help. Verses 1 through 3. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel nor seek the Lord. Yet he also is wise and will bring disaster, and does not retract his words, but will arise against the house of evildoers and against the help of the workers of iniquity. Now the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses are flesh and not spirit. So the Lord will stretch out his hand, and he who helps will stumble, and he who is helped will fall, and all of them will come to an end altogether. So don't count on them. They can't help you. Chapter 32, he comes back to more description of that glorious future that awaits Israel. Verses of that chapter. Behold, a king will reign righteously, and princes will rule justly, and each will be like a refuge from the wind, and a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry country, like the shade of a huge rock in a parched land. Then the eyes of those who see will not be blinded, and the ears of those who hear will listen, and the mind of the hasty will discern the truth, and the tongue of the stammerers will hasten to speak clearly. Furthermore, God is going to destroy the destroyer. He talks about that in chapter 33, first two verses. Woe to you, O destroyer, while you were not destroyed, and he who is treacherous, while others did not deal treacherously with him. As soon as you shall finish destroying, you shall be destroyed. As soon as you shall cease to deal treacherously, others shall deal treacherously with you. O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their strength every morning, our salvation also in the time of distress. God is going to destroy the destroyers, and he's going to do in the oppressors. Verses 19 through 20. You will no longer see a fierce people, a people of unintelligible speech which no one comprehends, of a stammering tongue which no one understands. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation, a tent which shall not be upholded. Its stakes shall never be pulled up, nor any of its cords be torn apart. In 34, verses 1 through 2, he is going to completely destroy those nations that have oppressed Israel. Draw near, O nations, to hear and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them, and he has given them over to slaughter. And this destruction that's going to come is going to be recompense for the cause of Zion. Verse 8 of that same chapter. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. And as a result, Zion will be made joyful. You see that in the next chapter, verses 5 through 6. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb will shout for joy. The waters will break forth in the wilderness, and the streams in the Arabah. In verse 10, and the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, with everlasting joy upon their heads. They will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Okay, the next section is the historical narrative. And in this section, it talks about the siege that Isaiah had said would come, that had predicted. And the Assyrians come, they besiege Jerusalem. But also, as Isaiah had predicted, they leave suddenly and by a sword that's not man's, as it says elsewhere. I'm going to have to skip some things to get through this. So I'm just going to skip to the Assyrian army leaving. That's in chapter 37, verse 36. Then the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, all these were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. And it came about, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his sons, killed him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat. And Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place. This is just as God had predicted would happen to the Assyrians. So we have a section in Isaiah where he's making these predictions, some of them short-term, some of them long-term, but then we break into historical narrative where he records the actual fulfillment of some of those things that were predicted. Obviously, I've got a problem. I think best if I just... I'm not going to read any more sections, I don't think. I'm just going to tell you what's in these remaining sections just briefly, and then I want to talk about the book as a whole. The next section is, I think, the most important section in the book, where it talks about the fact that Yahweh is the one who's in control of history. On several occasions, he explains that he has, in the past, talked about the former things. And by the former things, I think what he's saying is, I predicted back in the time of Abraham and the patriarchs, things that were going to come to pass with respect to Israel, and I brought them to pass. I think those are the former things. So the former things are the Exodus and entering into the land and conquering the land. Those are things that were all predicted hundreds of years in advance, and God brought them to pass. But then he goes on to say, and now there are new things. So I think what he's talking about is things that he is predicting now that will come to pass in the future. And he dares any God that's out there to demonstrate that they have the same kind of control over history that Yahweh does. And he says they can't do it. And in this section, he starts to introduce the servant. And there are several servant psalms that are sprinkled through this. And it slowly emerges this picture of this one coming in the line of David, who is going to be the kind of ruler that God intended from the very beginning. But he is going to be despised by his people. He is going to be, his appearance will be more marred than any man. He's going to be afflicted. He's going to be picked on. But he is going to bear the sins of the world. And he will introduce a rule of righteousness and justice. Then the last section, section 8, he talks more about how this servant is going to be the agent that brings salvation to the world. So, what is Isaiah about? It's describing the situation which God picked out of people, and he decided he was going to make them his own. And just like the picture of the vineyard, he did a lot for them. He took a people that was not a people. He took a bunch of nobodies. And he took them through a process whereby he showed himself to them and showed to them who he is, what he stands for, and made them into a people. How they responded to that, they have taken him for granted. In Judah, to a less extent than the Northern Kingdom of Israel. The Northern Kingdom of Israel, they just said they were not interested in Yahweh for the most part. They very quickly and openly began to worship other gods. In Judah, for the most part, they continued to worship Yahweh on the side. They were worshiping other gods, but they continued, for the most part, to worship Yahweh, with some exceptions. Some kings didn't worship Yahweh at all, even in the south, in Judah. But both the north and the south worshiped other gods whenever they thought that other gods would be more effective, would carry out their wishes more fully, would be more secure, would be safer. And there are several things that Isaiah wants the people of Israel to know in this situation. The first is, there is only one God, there is no rival. No one even compares. Second, Israel has a glorious future ahead of it that God prepared in advance. In that future, Judah will be the source of righteousness, justice, and peace for the whole world. The third thing, in order to be prepared for this destiny, Israel needs to be made righteous. And this will require more divine justice. That's what he's warning them of. That's what's coming. So Israel is going to be subjected to suffering. This does not mean that God has been overpowered. This does not mean that God is ignoring them or abandoning them. It's all part of the process that has to happen. It's actually God loving them. The fourth thing is that God is fully in control of history. And God's predictions and the fulfillment of those predictions is a demonstration of that fact. So, all of this will come to pass just as God said. Israel's oppressors will be defeated completely. Israel will be made righteous, just as he said. And Israel will rule the world. And the world will be in righteousness and peace. It's a refreshing picture of what is going to be. And it's that picture of what's going to be that is the driving force that gets us to hang in there while this process is being brought to fulfillment. There's wonderful passages in Isaiah. I actually encourage you to go through the sections that I didn't get to see those. We're out of time, so I'll just thanks.